This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. The Black Patch Tobacco Wars of the early 20th century pitted farmer against farmer as a group of men sworn to secrecy used destructive tactics to coerce collective action. Hopkinsville's Pinerolo Area Museum commemorates the war with several activities starting Friday, September 21st. Official historian for Hopkinsville and Christian County, William T. Turner, recounts the story of the tobacco war in conversation with Kate Lochte.
Mr. Turner, you are the go-to guy for why the tobacco war was so important to Hopkinsville, Christian County, and our region, really.
Yes, the Night Rider War, the effort of the Silent Brigade, as they first called, involved a 35-county area lying along the Kentucky-Tennessee line from Russellville, Kentucky, and Springfield, Tennessee, on the east, to Murray, Kentucky, and Parrish, Tennessee, on the west. And it was the most pronounced activity of military aggression, also to incite a tremendous cultural discussion all the way between the Civil War and the Civil Rights Movement of the 1960s and 70s.
The basis for this disruption to life is what?
James B. Duke, better known as Buck Duke, later the benefactor of Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Through his monopolistic effort of the American Tobacco Trust, placed a monopoly upon the sale of dark tobacco in the Black Patch, this 35-county area in western Kentucky and western Tennessee. And when he placed this stronghold on the sale of tobacco, then the farmers of the Black Patch, in desperation, rose up and fought that tobacco trust. And they first did it through the Planters Protective Association. And when they saw that it was not proving forceful enough, then a group, an element within the Planters Association, organized the Silent Brigade or the Night Riders and went about the country attempting to convince other farmers who had failed to join the association and hold their tobacco, thus to drive the price up, to convince them it would be to their best advantage to join the association. And they carried on their activities between about 1904 and 1910, 1911. They did it by scraping plant beds in the spring, whipping farmers who would not join the association along in the summer, and then to burn their barns in the fall before the tobacco was loaded on wagons for transport to the various markets that were about. Those principal markets were Hopkinsville and Russellville and Princeton in Kentucky and Clarksville in Tennessee.
Were there particular individuals responsible for the association's actions?
Well, we'll first of all start with the association, which disavowed any claim of connection to the Night Riders. The association was organized by a group of very prominent farmers and a few businessmen, both in Kentucky and Tennessee, principally led by Charlie Fort of Robertson County, Tennessee, and his friend Felix Ewing, who was a farm tobacco producer on the very largest scale. And they were joined by a group of men here in Kentucky as well, attempting to enforce the boycott that was the incentive, the motivation of the Tobacco Association. When that failed, then a group of men in Kentucky really took the bull by the horn, so to speak, and organized the Night Riders. And the alleged leader, and please keep in mind that in the ensuing trial, that all the leaders were found innocent. And so we must say they were alleged leaders, included Dr. David Amos, a beloved country doctor at Cobb in Colwell County. And he was supported by his second-in-command, Guy Dunning, a farmer who lived between Cobb and Wallonia. Those men were capable of whipping up a group of farmers and equipped them with the knowledge of military strategy to go forth in companies and attempt to coerce farmers to join the association. And these were the two men who principally were charged in the indictments brought by the grand jury for the destruction of public and private property. Those indictments leading to one of the most celebrated trials in the history of Western Kentucky. We know it as the Knight Rider trial, and we will, for the first time this year, in the same original courtroom, conduct for about an hour excerpts of the 1,000-page testimony of the trial. And Dr. Amos and Guy Dunning and others had charges filed upon them by the grand jury, based particularly upon five different Knight Riders who shared names and places and events. And so in that trial that came in March of 1911, Dr. Amos was accused of leading the raid on Hopkinsville on the 7th of December 1907. And after a week-long trial, Dr. Amos and all of those others indicted by the grand jury were found not guilty. I would hasten to remind you that of the 12 jurors, 11 of them were farmers, and one was a town carpenter here in Hopkinsville who had just moved into town from a lifetime of farming. And so I'll leave you to your own observations relative to the commitment of that jury, but they found him innocent.
I would like you to give me the time sequence then of what was the ultimate effect against the monopoly in relationship to the trial and what happened after the trial?
A very interesting question. You know, it has been said by others, the wheels of justice turn ever so slowly, but they do mete out justice. And at the time the Knight Rider trial was going on, there was an effort afoot by the Justice Department in Washington to get a rendering of a decision that the American Tobacco Trust, the organization of James B. Duke, was in violation of the 1890 Sherman Antitrust Act. And at the time the trial was going on, our trust-busting president some years before, Teddy Roosevelt, had given the government's green light for the Attorney General's office to file suit against the American Tobacco Trust for the violation of that Sherman Antitrust Act. And the Attorney General, who led that effort successfully to break the Duke Trust, was James Clark McReynolds, who was from Caledonia in Trigg County. And in years after this decision by the federal court in New York declaring the American Tobacco Trust in violation of the Sherman Antitrust Act, years later, President Franklin D. Roosevelt would appoint James Clark McReynolds to a seat on the United States Supreme Court. And in the late 1930s, as you remember from your study of history, James Clark McReynolds would become one of the, quote, nine old men, end quote, at the time that President FDR attempted to pack the Supreme Court. And so it just proves the point, when you're studying history in one phase and location, it is going to tie in like pieces of a puzzle with another time and place.
Were there uprisings like this elsewhere in the country in tobacco-growing areas?
Not to my knowledge. Now, there were at times some farmers up in the bluegrass who claimed a connection, but I don't have any real proof of it. There were farmers down in the Real Foot Lake area of northwest Tennessee that at times it appeared were on the verge of moving into a similar situation.
Mr. Turner, are you going to be a party in the trial?
I possibly will be. I'll certainly be a spectator. I have been the narrator for the Knight Rider reenactment, which our museum started in 1976. And we've skipped a few years, but I believe this year is the 30th year that the museum in Hopkinsville has put on the Knight Rider raid reenactment. And I'll be right on hand for that trial, if not part of it.
Well, I thank you for taking time with me.
You're most welcome, and I appreciate the interest of your listeners and invite them to Hopkinsville on the fourth weekend of September for our Knight Rider War Pilgrimage. We have an entire weekend of activities beginning on Friday night with the two runs of the reenactment, and then a tour of homes on Saturday morning, a Knight Rider dinner at one of our local eating establishments, Miss Ann's Tea Room, and then the reenactment of the trial, two runs of that at night on Saturday. And then Sunday afternoon, we'll have a progressive organ recital at various downtown churches that were here in that era. And for your listeners' interest, I would suggest they call the Penroyal Area Museum at Hopkinsville at 270-887-4270 to inquire about the prices for the various events and to put their name on the list, and we'd be so happy for the public to attend.
My impression is, Mr. Turner, that these events sell out.
Yes, they do. Well, in fact, the Night Rider reenactment sells out. Now, the other events are new this year, and we have every indication that they, too, will sell out.
Big weekend for your community, and I appreciate your sharing with me.
You're most welcome. Call on me anytime. I'll be glad to help if it's in the line of history. And Western Kentucky.
Kate Lockley spoke with official historian for Hopkinsville and Christian County, William T. Turner. For more information about the multiple events of Hopkinsville's Tobacco War Pilgrimage, September 21st through the 23rd, call the Penroyal Area Museum at 270-887-4270 or visit tobaccowarpilgrimage.com.
Recommended readings on the Black Patch Wars include The Tobacco Night Riders of Kentucky and Tennessee, 1905 to 1909 by James Nall, and On Bended Knees, The True Story of the Night Rider Tobacco War in Kentucky and Tennessee, by Kentucky Supreme Court Justice Bill Cunningham. Cunningham also gives tomorrow's keynote at Murray State's Constitution Day celebration. The title of his presentation, The Fourth Amendment, The Majesty of the Ruined Tenement, references a statement attributed to William Pitt while he was speaking about the cider excise tax in the British House of Commons in 1763. Judge Cunningham gave WKMS a preview of the speech this week.
You know who William Pitt was? First Earl of Chatham and English statesman and orator. The poorest man in his cottage bid defiance to all the forces of the crown. It may be frail, its roof may shake, the wind may blow through it, the storm may enter, the rain may enter, but the King of England may not enter. All his force dares not cross the threshold of the ruined tenement. That's basically the sentiment that's expressed by our Fourth Amendment to our Constitution. I'm sure you know that 10 amendments were passed after the original Constitution was passed. It was drafted in 1787, passed in 1789, but there was kind of a gentleman's agreement that the states would approve it on condition that they would be followed up by a Bill of Rights, which was basically 10 amendments, the fourth one being the protection against unlawful search and seizure. Basically protects us against the police state.
There are all sorts of new issues for this particular amendment, especially in the electronic age. Are you going to get into that?
I may get into some of the issues. The case law on that is moving so fast. We're beginning to edge into technology. Of course, that Katz case, U.S. versus Katz, years ago, really was one to establish the expectation of privacy, because up until then, you normally thought of an illegal search or illegal wiretapping had to do exclusively to your home. But that was a case where a man went into a phone booth, closed the door, and the phone booth was tapped, and that's when they said, no, it's not just in your own home, it's wherever you have the expectation of privacy, whether it's in your car, whether it's in your office, or whether it's in a room that you don't even own.
Well, the language is to be the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures. There's some debate about whether that means privacy or is it opposed to the security of the people, meaning all of us.
Yeah.
So it's the individual right versus the right of society to be secure.
Yeah. That Fourth Amendment deals with the right of persons to be secure. And also, it's debatable as whether or not there's a right to privacy under the Ninth Amendment. You know, it says all rights not herein enumerated or reserved to the rights of the people or something of that nature. That's been interpreted by some courts to include the right to privacy, and that was where they got into all the, I think, Roe versus Wade and some of the more controversial decisions and why some people don't think there is a constitutional right to privacy, depending upon your bent, and other people think there is. But that was a privacy, Ninth Amendment issue, not a Fourth Amendment issue.
So when you're speaking about the Fourth Amendment, what exactly will be the shape of your examination?
I am going to speak about the Fourth Amendment, but my whole speech is not going to be about the Fourth Amendment. I'm going to talk about how the miracle at Philadelphia, how fragile that whole construction of the Constitution was, that it has survived down through the years with 27 amendments. I'm going to get into the history of that. I'm also going to talk a little bit about on the Bill of Rights, those 10 amendments. One that very interesting to me now is the 10th Amendment, that's states' rights. And when Madison and the framers of the Bill of Rights were putting it all together, although states' rights was number 10, that was actually considered to be the most important of the whole bunch, because the resistance and opposition to the original Constitution was the federal government was going to roll right over the states, and the states weren't going to have any sovereignty. And that was the primary motivating force for any amendments at all. And then that, it just so happens that it was number 10. And, of course, now over the years, it's been eroded tremendously. And maybe some people think the death knell with the latest opinion by the U.S. Supreme Court on the health care bill.
As a living, breathing document, the Constitution continues to be front and center, especially this issue of states' rights, front and center in American politics today.
Yeah, I think that's the genius of it, and that's part of the miracle at Philadelphia. It wasn't just much that it got it passed, but they passed something that's endeared for 200 years. It started out a conglomeration of 13 states that were diverse, 1,400 miles long. Some of them at the convention probably had a hard time even understanding each other, diverse interest. They managed to hammer it together in the most difficult circumstances. And, you know, you had such strong personalities, but the compromise was a big issue. But then it's passed down through the years and been able to survive, really, with 17 amendments, actually, because the first 10 were kind of in conjunction with the original document.
But the interpretation of the U.S. Constitution is still very contentious.
Well, the Constitution is what the U.S. Supreme Court says it is. That's the very point of controversy, and they're constantly having to reinterpret it. But therein again, that's what makes it malleable and flexible, because it is capable of being interpreted.
The Honorable Justice Bill Cunningham caps off Murray State's Constitution Day tomorrow with a keynote address at 7 o'clock in the Kerr Center Theater. Hourly scholarly discussions commence at 9:30 and continue through 3:30. All discussions are in the Friedkirch Auditorium in the Industry and Technology Building, except for the 11:30 to 12:30 session on religion and the Constitution, which will be in the Barclay Room of the Kerr Center. All activities are open to the public.
Just ahead, futurist Ivan Potter discusses the lasting effects of this year's historic drought. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News.
This is Front Page Sunday. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. Ivan Potter is a futurist and publisher of the West Kentucky Journal. Mr. Potter has advised governors of the Commonwealth and presidents of the United States on rural development and intergovernmental relations. Today he's joining us in the studio to talk about a recent article of his published in the Journal that looks at the effects of the recent drought on Mississippi River traffic in terms of hard data. Mr. Potter, thanks for coming on the program.
Thank you.
We've seen quite a bit of rain recently. Has that gotten river traffic moving again?
It is moving slowly. The danger is that the sandbars keep shifting, and when you are pulling, say, 9 barges and a tow, and you're about 300 or 400 feet long, 50 to 70 feet wide, it's hard to maneuver. And so the Corps has been very careful about maintaining that the traffic has to have a clear waterway. The last time it was closed was just south of Memphis, and the sandbars, like overnight, just came up. And so they had to, for a period of about 2 weeks there. And the water has helped out a lot now. But it's always a danger that it will drop down. This time last year, we had the river was 52 feet over flood stage. Today, it's between 6 and 10 feet below average. And at Columbus, we're still got water, but on down south, it's going to be a problem for a while.
Hmm. How much damage do you think that this drought has done to the river industry?
That's a good question. In our area, Ingram Barge is probably the good example to go with. It is now one of the largest barge corporations in the world. They just finished acquiring about 600 barges and 40 tow boats. They have a facility at Columbus that they repair from. And they move along a 17-state waterway, which is connected through the Mississippi. If the Mississippi does not flow, that affects all everything upstream. So it's crucial. That river has to maneuver because it's the interstate for mid-America.
Hmm.
Damage-wise, I can tell you that in lost revenue for West Kentucky, when we did our research, there were 2 million acres that corn, wheat, and soybean lost product from. And that equaled to about, it was 1 million acres, and it was $2 billion of damage. And that was from 24 counties. Well, if you compare the fact that nationally during the hard peak of the drought, it was 1,487 counties at risk in America.
Hmm.
We do not know yet for sure just how much money-wise, but it's going to be in the billions, major, major billions. The danger is if this continues next year as well.
Right.
If we have a dry winter and it moves into a drier spring, and then instead of the 100-degree heat coming into maybe early May or whatever, it starts to move into April.
Mm-hmm.
So this is the third year of our drought season. We've had three. This makes the third year now.
Do you see any way to recovery aside from more rain?
Yes. The rain will come again, but our man's activities are beginning to be questioned. In my research, I found in an obscure scientific journal some mention that part of they think the reason why the river levels dropped very fast in the Mississippi was the extreme fracking material situation in North Dakota, that maybe the fracking had taken out a lot of water supply for the headwaters of the Mississippi all of a sudden, combined at the right time when the drought hit and the hardest. So you have decreased water supply coming in from the headwaters. You have no rain. I think I quit counting after 142 days of no rain. And all that added, plus you have vast farming activities. When you sink a 10, 12, 15-inch well into the ground and you're drawing water up at, say, 2,500 gallons a minute for agricultural purposes,
right.
This water is a finite supply. And when all these factors start to grab at it, then the river, when it gives it up, it can't produce it again until it rains. So we've got to look at how we as humans are interacting with nature all of a sudden.
It sounds like, forgive the term, but it sounds like it was a perfect storm this year.
It was. Hmm. It was. And when the weather people pray for hurricanes to come in your area and dump water,
right.
It's not a good situation.
So you think this could signal some kind of permanent change?
Yes. I started to be concerned about 3 years out when, in Clinton, Kentucky, a small town, we have businesses, older buildings, are 100 years old, brick. And I noticed that the temperatures in August were edging up, and when it went to 105 degrees for about a week, I thought, well, this is very unusual for this time of year.
Mm-hmm.
So everyone said, it's just a quirk, it's a part of nature, let it go. Then last year, again in late August, we had what I call a very intense heat storm, and where we had 3 days where the heat index was over 122 degrees. And that one of those days, NBC had reported that Owensboro was the hottest point in North America, 121 degrees that they knew of, hard temperature. I did not know it, but that same day, we had a generator left over from the ice storm days with 5 gallons of gasoline in it. Well, evidently, the heat was so intense, it melted the gasket around the one of the areas holding some of the gas in. And I knew about it because the restaurant next to us came over and said, our customers are getting sick over here on fumes coming from your building. Well, I went back, and sure enough, there was gas pouring out over our storage area with all paper. And someone who does heating and cooling told me they had a similar problem in an attic where their headband had melted one morning. When temperature starts to do that, it's different, okay? And then this year, of course, instead of having a tight, concentrated week of a problem, you have months of over 100-degree heat. So I'm hoping this is a phenomenon that's just one time, but we have now three hard summers in a row. And there's a possibility we might have fourth, fifth, and sixth. I'm worried about drought. I'm worried about our senior citizens who, if you look at their air conditioning systems, they're mostly made and designed for the 1990s mm-hmm. temperatures. And if you're running your cooling system at 98 or at full capacity and all you can get is down to 95 degrees from 110, you know, at some point they start to break.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in the river counties, Ballard, Carlisle, Hickman, and Fulton, you have a lot of senior citizens who have older systems and very few repair people.
So, if they have any systems at all.
Exactly, or maybe they're using fans. And we now have the specter of if we have a very, very harsh heat storms again, people will die if they don't take care to move to cooling centers. And if our elected officials ignore this, I can almost guarantee there will be tragedy here.
Mm.
We forget that in France, I think about 20 years ago, there was a heat storm, and 35,000 people died in Paris because there was no air conditioning, and they were not used to the heat that came. Chicago had a similar event a few years ago. So weather is turning, and I think we have to learn how to adapt. But it's also going to take leadership.
Futurist Ivan Potter is also publisher of the West Kentucky Journal. Mr. Potter, thanks for speaking with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
The Paducah Symphony Orchestra's artistic director and conductor is Raffaele Ponti. Maestro Ponti and the orchestra are enjoying successes with each other. Several standing ovations during their recent season opening concert evidence that capacity audiences are delighted to hear them perform together. Kate Lochte has more.
Maestro, we are featuring the program of the Paducah Symphony Orchestra's September 8th program later this morning at 11 when we preempt our regular encore presentation of A Prairie Home Companion. I'd appreciate your preparing us for this listening experience to the orchestra's opening night, Rhapsody in Blue.
The opening night of our season was spectacular, Kate. The crowd filled to capacity. I have never experienced this before. We opened the concert with the Capriccio Italiano Tchaikovsky. It's an amazing work. Today, we tweet, we Facebook, we communicate so quickly. I know what everybody had for breakfast in the concert halls. But in those days, an artist or a composer had to document it with their tools. Tchaikovsky had to come back after his trip to Italy and somehow describe and document through music his experience. Not just what he saw or what he did or what he ate, but the feeling, the emotion, the character of what happened. And in this music, you'll actually hear music of the streets, music of the people, some military bands, some real essence of the culture and of the rhythm of the people, the rhythm of the language. It's absolutely a beautiful piece of music. We played this, and by the last note, the audience was up on their feet for a standing ovation. I've never seen that before.
It's interesting that the music of the streets that Tchaikovsky captured is said to have inspired George Gershwin as well, the music of the train.
Absolutely right. That's why this was like a perfect fit. So Jeffrey Beagle comes out on the stage to play George Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Probably one of the most recorded pieces of all time. Everybody knows it. It has such a commercial value to it. But Jeffrey's been working at this piece for so many years. He says to me, listen, I've just discovered that there are 50 measures of music that have been taken out of this piece that George Gershwin wrote. And I found this work. And I want to do the original version. Can you imagine taking a piece of a painting and deciding after all these years that the Mona Lisa should be blonde and we're going to change her dress and we're going to fix this and make it more snappy, more contemporary so people can really appreciate this? Well, publishers and editors, when they heard the work, decided that it was too long. People won't take it. It's too long because in all these piano cadenzas and all these little segues that make this piece so fluid, they chopped all these solo parts out and just abruptly put the orchestra back into place. And we've just come to learn it this way. Now, with these 50 measures back in place, which we did on Saturday night, it just makes it so much more fluid, understandable, and the key structures just flow nicely back and forth. It's so beautiful that I can't even listen to the other version anymore. This was really an amazing piece of music, because now the orchestra is sitting there, they know this piece with their eyes closed, but now they're hearing something different for the first time, an old work in a new way. It was extraordinary.
I understand Mr. Beagle could neither speak nor hear until surgery fixed problems for him at age three?
Exactly right. He had a rough beginning. His parents never thought he'd ever be able to play the piano. And I have to tell you, I've done this work with many, many pianists. He plays this Cuban rhythm stuff that Gershwin was influenced and put in this piece. I have never heard a technically proficient performance like this. The swing and the groove he achieves is extraordinary.
And Mr. Gershwin wrote this piece on a very quick turnaround basis, I understand.
He really did. I think the process and the idea of him wanting to write this piece, he had thought about this for a long time, but the actual pen to paper was a quick turnaround. And he also probably had, because of the jazz idiom, the Cuban feel to it, all these different things in his mind from travel, from hearing things, from having one foot in Tin Pan Alley and the other at Carnegie Hall, he knew exactly what he wanted to hear, and he knew also pianistically, the solo aspect of it, what he wanted to show off from his technique. So when he went to put it down on paper, it was just a matter of realizing it.
Now, tell me about the closer and composer Giuseppe Martucci.
You know, this is a very funny thing to me. There's so much beautiful music out there. We just don't simply have enough time to perform it all. Giuseppe Martucci was a great pianist, obviously composer, and conductor, very successful, coming out of Naples, Italy. Now, when we think of music coming from Italy, we think of opera and maybe the Baroque period, you know, Vivaldi, Pella, all these great early music, Monteverdi, all these beautiful things. But we don't think of symphonic music coming from Italy. This is one of the greats. He wrote two symphonies and a couple of piano concertos that are exquisite. For some reason, they're played in Italy and in Europe, but don't make it to the United States. And I can't figure out why. Riccardo Muti is doing a little bit now with Chicago, and they championed his works in Italy, being from Naples himself. But it's funny being able to like have a premiere of music written 100 years ago. That is so beautiful. And the influences are Brahms and Schubert. And I even hear Bruckner in his writing. This was what he loved, what he listened to. And you'll hear all these colors, the form of Brahms, the singability in the second movement of the Schubert song, and the layering and almost fugue writing of Bruckner. It's absolutely beautiful music. And it brings an element of something I haven't heard before, but I'm going to love this to our audience. This orchestra is on fire. The Paducah Symphony is on fire. Our community couldn't be more loving. I mean, I can't wait to get to the next concert.
Well, tell us about the next concert. It's October 13th, and it's Young and Mighty.
Young and Mighty. This features our two concerto competition winners, which we hold at Murray State University every year. I was privileged to be on the panel this year for the first time. I was blown away by the level of the performances. These high school kids amaze me with such great repertoire. The violinist who won is playing the first movement of the Korngold Concerto, and we have a pianist, a young boy who's going to do the Liszt Hungarian Fantasy. I mean, these both are challenging, very, very difficult works. Not only to play technically because of the notes and the structure of the thing, but they're complex. And what is impressing me the most about this is the level of maturity at such a young age. How do you understand this at such a young age? I'm sure as these artists grow and they develop their careers, which is the whole point of encouraging these type of competitions and giving them this experience to play with a professional orchestra while still in high school, they're going to grow into it, and they're going to feel differently about it in a couple of years or 10 years or 30 years from now. They're going to say, I'm really growing into this more, and I feel better about this, or I feel a different way about something. But the level of maturity right now is just extraordinary. I get to open up with a Beethoven overture. The big war horse on this one is a Dvorak symphony. Now, we all know number 9. from the New World. Number 8 is very popular. I'm doing number 7. He pulls his folk tunes right from his homeland, lays them in, and then develops them beautifully. It's arguably the finest symphony he's ever written.
Fabulous. Maestro, thank you.
Hey, thank you, and I hope to see all your listeners at the Symphony Hall.
Symphony Hall is, of course, the Carson Center in Paducah, but as previously mentioned, you can also hear the Paducah Symphony Orchestra exclusively on the radio with us. We are broadcasting September 8th season opening concert today from 11 to 3 here on 91.3 WKMS and WKMS HD2. Now bear with me because it gets a little bit confusing now. You can hear 91.3 HD2 over the air and online at WKMS.org. You can also hear WKMS HD2 in Paducah at 92.5 and in Madisonville at 105.1. We feature two more broadcasts of this concert on WKMS HD2 tomorrow morning at 9 and Wednesday at noon. See all the dates of our broadcast for the entire season in our fall listening guide. You can request a guide at msu.wkms@murraystate.edu if you don't already receive one as a contributing member. There are also a host of free concerts this week at Murray State, including a program for four strings, music from Mozart, Beethoven, and Dvorak. That's in the Performing Arts Hall on Tuesday at 6 o'clock. There's a mallet music concert on the 20th in the Performing Arts Hall at 7:30, and the Festival of Champions High School Marching Band in competition is at Murray State's Stewart Stadium all day on Saturday. And then this afternoon, though, you can hear tenor Randall Black and soprano Sonia Baker give a faculty recital at 3:30 in the Performing Arts Hall. When we come back on Front Page Sunday, learn about a Japanese fall festival coming to Murray and the history behind Fulton's Banana Festival. This is Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. I'm Chad Lampe.
And I'm Todd Hatton. As seasons begin to change from summer to autumn, harvest festivals around the Northern Hemisphere are starting. In Japan, one of the traditions for the fall is the Kagura dance. Murray State College of Humanities and Fine Arts Dean Dr. Ted Brown, with help from members of the MSU Theater Department and Rather Museum, is bringing the Japanese dance troupe Iwami Kagura to the university next Tuesday. Shelley Baskin spoke with Dr. Brown about the presentation.
Dr. Brown, you've got a Japanese dance troupe called Iwami Kagura. What exactly is going on with their dance? What do they do?
What they do is a traditional, now it's a folk dance in Japan. It had religious origins as part of a religious ceremony. Shinto is the native religion to Japan. And they have a big autumn festival, and These dances, there are 30 of them actually, they arose out of religious ceremony at a festival that they had to thank the gods for a bountiful harvest. And then with the passage of time during the 19th century, it sort of evolved into a folk art. And there are these various companies that perform. The Kagura is the kind of dance, and Iwami is the area that these particular dancers are from. And this kind of dance is most, that's a region of Japan that it's most popular in. This group is from Shimane Prefecture, which is on the northwest side of the southern end of Honshu, the main island in Japan. And again, it's a very popular thing in many areas, but this Iwami is sort of the heart of this art form, and so we're very fortunate to have this group coming, and some of them have been doing this for 50 years, 45, 50 years, and so there's a range of ages, and they have other professions, and they do this out of love for this art form.
So have you seen one of these dances before?
No, I have not, and I am very much looking forward to it. I have seen a DVD of a couple of the dances, one of which they'll perform here, and it's truly amazing. The costumes are beautiful, the music is powerful, and it's just an experience unlike any other.
Yeah, so is this pretty up-tempo dance, or does each one have kind of its own character since they're doing 30?
And they're going to perform only two while they're here. And yes, they are very different, and the repertoire varies, and the music kind of goes along with the story. Mm-hmm. Like the main, I think the most dramatic of these two will be Orochi, which is, it tells the story of an eight-headed serpent who has eaten seven of the eight daughters of a poor old mountain couple and now is coming for the eighth.
Oh, man.
So the hero's going to come in and rescue that maiden and slay the eight-headed serpent.
Wow, that sounds pretty intense.
It is. It's just amazing.
So I understand there's also going to be a workshop for some high school students just before the show. What's going on with that?
Yes, the group was good enough to agree to do a workshop at Callaway County High School. Masayo Nakamura teaches Japanese at Callaway County High School and Callaway County Middle School. And she received the award as the best Japanese public school teacher in the country a couple years ago, the Heinz Award. So she's an outstanding teacher. And the troupe is going to come and work with her students. It's going to happen in the gym, and the actors are going to let some of those middle and high school students like try on the serpent costume and work with the students in various ways. So when we have artists and so forth come to town, when we can, we try and tie it in with outreach to the public schools. And this is the perfect opportunity to do that.
And so how did you manage to bring them out here? Who were you working with?
This is co-sponsored by the Japan Foundation and the Consulate General of Japan in Nashville. And we were contacted by the consulate about the opportunity to host this group, and we're invited to do so. And we have a relationship with them through our Japanese major, which was the first one in Kentucky. But Professor Yoko Hatakeyama and Dr. Masayo Kaneko are our Japanese instructors. And the Japanese program at Murray State is well known to the consulate in Nashville, and we take our students down to a speech contest every year, and our students do well in that. And there's a new consul who's kind of the second in command at the consulate there, and she is coming up and staying for the duration for 2 days here in Murray, and we'll go to the performances and see our Japanese program. So we're very excited about the chance to meet her and show her what a great program we have. So everything is kind of coming together, and it's a big Japanese event for all of us.
That sounds great. Well, Dr. Brown, thank you for coming and telling me about it.
Absolutely. Thank you for having me.
Iwami Kagura will perform at 7 p.m. this Tuesday in Rather Auditorium at Murray State University. The performance is free and open to anyone who wants to attend.
It's been 50 years since Fulton, Kentucky has hosted the first Banana Festival, and joining me on the line is festival organizer Christy Rogers. Christy, this year's festival runs from September 22nd through the 29th, and I'm going to start with the most obvious question that locals in Fulton know, but I bet many of our listeners outside of Fulton don't know this, but why is it, Christy, that it's called the Banana Festival?
Well, everybody asks that question. In about 1880, around that time, I guess, the Illinois Central Gulf Railroad, you know, had first developed their refrigerated cars. And Fulton happened to be one of the large railroad facilities right there that was a redistribution point. And so it's kind of a central location between New Orleans and Canada. So Fulton had an ice house right on that railroad, and it would kind of was the route north to Chicago, and we would ice them down here when they came from South America, and then be able to redistribute them across the country. And at one point, about 70% of the bananas that were consumed in the U.S. came through Fulton. So we were known as the banana capital of the world.
And that started the festival there. You also had international visitors come in for the festival too, right?
Oh, yes, that was a really big deal. We had the Amigos, and some other people would host families and students that would come from Ecuador and El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, Costa Rica, a lot of different places that would come to participate in our festival.
Again, this has been 50 years since the first one, but this festival has had different names over the years.
Yes. For a while, it went for 30 years. It ran from 1962 to 1992 as the Banana Festival, or the International Banana Festival. And then it changed to Pontotoc Festival and then to Railroad Heritage Days, which, you know, to celebrate the railroads here and some other things with Indians in this area. Then I guess I would say probably a new generation of all of us who were children and grew up with it wanted to see it come back for our children. So we proposed to bring it back, and we did last year, and it just made a huge comeback, a huge hit. We had thousands of people here on the Saturday of our parade, and so we're expecting this year to be the 50th birthday to be even bigger.
You know, there have been a lot of efforts over the past few years to revitalize buildings in Fulton and try to bring some commerce and jobs back to this town. How has the Banana Festival played into those efforts to make the community better there in Fulton?
Well, we've had a tremendous community outpouring of participation in the festival last year and this year as well. As last year, our parade lasted, I'd say, an hour and 15 minutes, which was a big deal for us. And a lot of people put floats in, people really getting excited, having something to be excited about again. I think that has probably been the key point. And, yes, I would say that the Let's Paint the Town that we've done has made our downtown look fantastic. And that has helped also with the way everything looks for our festival.
Tell me about the one-ton banana pudding. Will there be one ton of banana pudding this year at the festival?
Well, I have to admit, last year we had a huge container that was made and donated by Union City Glass in Union City, Tennessee, and they said that really we didn't have any way to weigh it to know if it was exactly a ton. But if not, it was pretty close. I wouldn't say if it was over or under, but we just said it was a ton of banana pudding.
We could have a big meal if we had the ham biscuit from the Trigg County Ham Festival and we had the banana pudding, the one ton of pudding from the Banana Fest. We'd have a big meal for Western Kentucky.
Right.
Well, tell me about some of the highlights of this year's festival. I know you've got a couple of concerts scheduled.
Yes. Friday night we'll have our Buddy Jewel concert, and right before that we'll have our Fulton's Got Talent winner. And anybody can participate from any town in that on Thursday night. And the winner wins $500, and we'll get to open for Buddy Jewel that night. So that's kind of exciting. And then Saturday night, we'll have the Joe Diffie concert. And right prior to that, we'll have our parade and hand out free pudding. And that day, we'll have a tremendous amount of things going on with a 5K run and pistol shoot, car show, a banana wrestling brawl, ping pong tournament, you name it.
I saw that you've got a cemetery walk, and that sounds interesting to me as part of the festival.
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
That is it's a cemetery here in town, and it is famous people that lived in this town and did things for this town will be a reenactment. There will be people that will dress up as them, and we'll go around. I forget exactly how long the tour will take, but they'll do a certain amount of people at certain times, between 4 and 6 o'clock on Saturday. A rain date will be on Sunday. But they'll just reenact the lives of those people and tell you the history of Fulton.
There are a lot of things that are going on at the festival, and if you'd like to know more about it, you can check out WKMS.org. We'll have a link to the festival website where you have the entire calendar of events. And Christy Rogers, I want to thank you very much for taking time out of your busy week ahead of the Banana Festival, which is again from September 22nd through the 29th in Fulton. Christy, thank you very much for taking time to talk with us today.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Front Page Sunday from WKMS News. Our correspondents are Drew Adams, Shelley Baskin, Angela Hatton, Casey Northcutt, and Rose Kristen Presson. Kate Lochte is a contributing producer, and Matt Mark Graff provides website assistance.
If you have comments or questions about the stories you've heard today, you can email us at msu.wkmsnews@murraystate.edu. You can also have your say on our Facebook page, and there's a link to that at our website, wkms.org, where you can also hear any of today's features again. Thanks for listening.